Welcome to episode 445. The modern teenager with a phone glued to their hand, a screen to look at every room they walk into, and an IV drip of ultra-processed sugary foods, that group of kids are in a mental health crisis of proportions that we've never seen before. You might even have a kid or young adult child yourself that has major battles with their mental health. And to be honest, as a young adult, that was once me too. On this episode, we talk with a Harvard University psychiatrist about the recovery of and the prevention of suicidal ideation that comes from having a shattered self-esteem and self-image and sadly leads to these kids hating themselves. And honestly, if you have a partner or you yourself are a sensitive person or an empath, this episode might teach you a lot about who and why you are the way you are, even if you're well into your adult years. This is a really good conversation, and I'm glad that I had this conversation at the earliest possible stage of my own kid's life. All right. Let's get into it.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? I hope you're having a splendid day and some good news. If you're here, it's about to get better. So this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down, not just the number on the scale. If you're fed up with short-term diets that aren't sustainable and you're going up and down and up and down with your weight and you want to fix it all for good, then scroll to the show notes or the caption down below and book a call with my team or myself and let's see if we can help in any way. Okay. Here with me today is Dr. Blaise Aguirre, whom has been on the psychiatry team at the McLean Hospital in Massachusetts in the US of A for over 25 years. This man is recognized globally for his work with teens and adolescents in the area of mood and personality disorders such as bipolar. He's also authored a number of books on both bipolar and written some books on unique forms of psychotherapy. And his latest book has just been released called I Hate Myself, which is the perfect door for me to walk through to have a very interesting conversation. Blaise, my friend, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's bitterly cold here in Boston. It's minus 10 degrees out, and I don't have too much envy, but I think I could have some of your weather right now.
Yeah, it's the other end of the spectrum over here. So we're having, I think today will be 37, which is close to 95, maybe Fahrenheit.
Yeah we're so. at 10 with the wind chill. In Fahrenheit.
That's under zero for us.
Yeah.
I'm curious to have this conversation because there's so many things that pop up when, you know, I looked into your work and the title of your book. But having worked in hospitals myself and sort of, you know, wrestled with the challenges of mainstream Western medicine and the limitations that I perceived to exist, I'm curious what your perception of psychiatry is. And the reason I say that is because in the personal development, psychology, you know, mindset world, we often look at psychiatrists as wannabe psychologists. And what I mean by that is they just want to throw drugs at a psychological problem. So that's kind of the general idea. And often when I, you know, am with clients and patients myself, they're like, oh, I've seen a psychiatrist. Part of me thinks, oh God, like, here we go. We've got someone that's just going to shoot the problem down with piles of drugs. What is your own perception of the field of psychiatry?
Yeah. No, what a wonderful question. And actually not one that I've been asked before. And so I think it's such an important one. And actually the head of psychology called me a psychologist in psychiatrist clothing. So, you know, look, there's definitely some conditions in mental health that require psychopharmacology. People with severe delusional disorders, schizophrenia, maybe they've got hallucinations, maybe they've got severe bipolar disorder, and they've got manic episodes, you know, they cannot sleep. And I am all for prescribing in those conditions. But I worry that we have pathologized normal human experiences and that a lot of healing comes from within. A lot of solving life's problems comes through developing skill sets and developing healthy practices that allow us to overcome things like anxiety and worry thoughts and some forms of inattention. Now, of course, if somebody is so severely depressed that they cannot get out of bed, that they, you know, bedridden, they aren't showering, they're not eating, you know, we have to take that very, very seriously. But life isn't a psychological problem. It's not that you can go into the DSM and say, okay, there's ADHD, OCD, depression, and life. And like, we're going to pathologize life, you know? And I think that we've pathologized too many things. One of the things that I discovered when I started using dialectical behavior therapy, what I really loved about that form of treatment for suicidal people is that it did two things. One is it used skills, imagining that people didn't choose to have mental problems, but they just didn't have the skill to be able to manage on the one hand. But the other part of it is a very Eastern philosophy of contemplation and meditation. And that is that for most people, the very present moment isn't so bad. It's just, I mean, it might be too hot there. It might be too cold over here. It's not such a bad moment. The badness is created inside our own mind because we spend time living in what if rather than what is. Let's change that F to an S. Or thinking about all the terrible things that happened in the past. And of course, if you live in those states, you're going to be sick because that's all you're playing over and over in your head. So what I liked is this idea of really present moment living within using and applying skills that you didn't have to overcome the barriers to healthier thinking and being.
I feel it for me personally, as a millennial, I was born into this generation that got access to the internet when it wasn't around. Like, you know, I remember phones that were tied to the wall and you have to go around the corner so your mum didn't hear you talking to your girlfriend. So I started with that and then ended up as a young adult in this world where access to everything was on my phone. And so it brings up this idea in regards to the conversation around what is versus what if, is that was the introduction of a million times what if than had previously existed because it was on my phone. It was, you know, on the computer. We were glued to screens where we're constantly being reminded, you know, the news was all bad. And I kind of gave up listening to the news a very long time ago. But then you go into social media and it's all like the positive, the possibilities, the amazingness, everything you could be. And it kind of puts you into this delusional state of all these, like chasing all of these dreams, none of which can happen if you're chasing all of them. And so I guess in the work that you do, do you think the internet or social media is part of the problem for facilitating this delusion of what if?
Yeah. Well, you know, earlier on we were chatting a little bit and, you know, you tell me that you do, say, cold plunges or something like that. I mean, I'm assuming you look pretty fit, you work out.
Yeah, I'm very sore at the moment. I've had a big week of working out.
Oh, you have? Okay. But you know what? If you lifted just another 5 more pounds, you'd be fabulous and you'd like yourself even more. And if you ate 10 more grams of my protein, you would be even stronger. And so what happens is I market to your self's dissatisfaction. Yeah. I tell you that you could be more beautiful, more handsome, stronger, more six-packy, maybe even 8-packy, if you only did what I told you to do. And there's so many of these like promises that are out there and that make us face our own dissatisfaction. And that's one thing if, you know, you get caught up in all of that. But I think, you know, if you really struggle with liking yourself, it can really compound the problem. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, back in the old days, you'd have to wait 1 month until the new magazine with Arnold Schwarzenegger came out and, you know, you said, okay, you know, but you weren't getting bombarded every single minute with these messages. So yeah, so I think there's this toxic idea of what you might be or what you could be. And it's all external to you, according to the media, that what we've lost is a sense of internal ability that we all have. And that we have to have had, otherwise we would not have survived as a species. I mean, imagine during the Ice Ages, it wasn't like people saying, you know, where's my 1-800 buy protein? You know, it was like, God.
They were saying, where's the sun?
Where's the sun and where's the mastodon so we can eat something for the next couple of months, you know?
Yeah. Do you think that manifests differently in adults to children in your experience, like that perception of what if?
I think so, because, I mean, there, you know, if you weren't brought up in an age where you're being bombarded with so many messages, and let's just even put social media aside, I was visiting a friend of mine and for dinner, and they wanted to keep their kids entertained. They had, I don't know how many channels, 50 channels with kids' TV. If they didn't like one show, then it was the other one. I mean, I remember growing up, you know, at 6 o'clock, it was, you know, Cinderella, and you either watched it or you missed it. But now, you know, now you can watch it whenever you want. And if you don't like that, you can go to SpongeBob or you can, you know, move somewhere else. So it's not even necessarily just in social media. There's this constant targeting of our reward centers, and people get addicted just as much to social media, TV, constant gratification, and they don't know what to do if that's not around. I think that maybe the best thing that could happen to society is be a massive like power outage. In South Africa, when I visit my dad, they have these rolling blackouts where, you know, for 4 hours, you've got no electricity and you have to entertain yourself. And it's like, what am I going to do? You know? And I think, I mean, we've robbed children of that opportunity, I think. And so I think it does differentially impact kids and adults.
Yeah, we seem to be in this world. And as I mentioned before, I'm almost about to step into fatherhood and parenthood myself. And, you know, based on, I guess, the existence of this podcast and many listeners know, you know, the choices that we're going to make about nutrition and avoidance of sugar and avoidance of screens and how we operate at home in order to prevent what seems like this societal tsunami of behavioral issues in children. It's odd that it seems like it's extreme, like it's extreme parenting, or you can be judged for, you know, depriving your children, which is really just trying to create the childhood that we had, which was seemingly on face value less traumatic and less like story producing of all the problems that might exist in the future or that do exist right now. And so like, how do you work with these kids and families that have been born into screen world that are just, you know, and I was at the gym yesterday and it's amazing that people can bring their little kids along, but the only way that they shut up is to stare at an iPad for an hour like a zombie.
Yeah. Well, I was worried about this. So I've got 4 kids. The youngest one is now 21, but they were certainly at a time when screens were widely available. My solution was to tell them to figure things out. And so what would happen is they were hungry. I said, what are you going to do about it? So they weren't like Uber Eats or anything else like that. They had smelly clothes. Okay, what are you going to do about it? So they had to figure things out. And I made them, I'd also like turn getting to school into like a fun activity. So I would say, okay, it's 1 kilometer to the school. If you run down this path, and it's 3 kilometers for me by car. You guys run down the path and I'll drive around and we'll see who gets there first. You know, so the one thing that, and a lot of people thought like, wow, that is, you know, why are you making your kids do their laundry and cook their food? And, you know, like you're the psychiatrist, you know, you could probably make a good salary and you can afford to have people do these things. And I thought like, because I'm not going to deprive my kids of solving ordinary problems. You know, it's like, I want them to solve ordinary problems because their ability, they'll, you know, later on in life, it's not about washing your clothes or getting to school or feeding yourself. It's about other problems, opening up bank accounts and whatever it is. And when they've had the experience of solving their own problems, they know that they can do that, you know. So my recommendation is always it's okay that they fail. I mean, here I am at the top of the psychiatric world at Harvard Medical School. And my first year in college, I got a D in psychology of personality. And I show everybody my report card that says, I got a D in psychology of personality. What did that tell me? That I had to better probably open the books and start studying if that's what I want to do, you know? So it's about, I think, not depriving children of the opportunity to figure something out, not to be so quick to solve the problem for them. It's okay. You know, just one other thing is I asked my son, we went hiking in outside Las Vegas in the desert. And I said, tell me all the brilliant things I told you as a dad. He says, I don't remember any of them, but I'll tell you what, I remember how you made me feel. And I felt safe. You know, I felt safe. And it's just like, cause I would say, it's okay. Like, okay, you can't figure it out. Let's just put it down. We'll figure it out some other time. You know, and then, yeah, of course, I'm going to help them out while they figure something out, but I'm not going to do 4. And it's, you know, it's not the frustration of immediately solving the problem. doesn't help to immediately solve the problem because it makes it look as if it's easy.
Yeah. Another thing that we've learned in sort of the last few weeks as we're looking into parenting styles and tips and hacks and things like that is that when it comes to doing the dishes or doing your washing or doing all of these things that are, you know, annoying, is that we actually project that they're annoying or frustrating onto our kids. Kids have no idea. They're a blank canvas. They have no idea that eating the food is the good bit and the dishes are the bad bit.
Right.
And so we've talked about trying to consciously be like, oh, eating food comes with dishes. That's just, they're part of the same bundle and there's no good part or bad part. Now I'm going to be challenged by that because I hate doing dishes.
Right. Well, listen, I did too. I grew up in South Africa and I never did dishes until I came to the States. And then now I use dishwashing as meditation. And actually, I look forward to washing the dishes now. Something I could never have imagined. But remember, was it Tom Sawyer who's like whitewashing the fence and, you know, his friends want to go to the river with him and all that. And, you know, and they say, oh, that's too bad that you're whitewashing the fence. And, you know, we're going down to the river. And he says, wow, this is just like so much fun to like whitewash. You get to paint and everything. At the end, he gets them all doing the work for him because he turns something that is seem as onerous as something that is productive and something that is fun. And, you know, like you can get competitive dishwashing, like, you know. Let's see who can do the dishes the fastest and the cleanest and put them away. You know, you get an extra star or something.
Yeah. Do you think that the idea of making it fun and engaging also sets them up for a dopamine response for a task that really should be, is part of life? It's just, you know, these things are mundane and we should be able to survive the experience without a dopamine craving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, the other way to do it is what I did with one of my sons who didn't tend to do much of his dishes or his laundry.
That was me.
Until he got a girlfriend. Yeah, exactly. Well, no, I used to take pictures of his photos of his room and I'd say, I'm going to show this to your girlfriends. Because whenever he would get a girlfriend and then, you know, suddenly his room would be spotless. I used to like just said, okay, look, I'm closing the door. I'm putting all the dishes on your bed and all the laundry that you haven't washed, you know, is in your room. And you're going to have to figure this out, you know, like if you need my help, I'll be there with you. But you're going to have to figure this out because I just don't want to. So I don't think it was necessarily fun in a dopamine rewarding kind of way. Maybe if a girl was coming over, it would be more fun. But it was also in sense of like, I mean, look, I just can't live in this pigsty anymore.
Yeah. You know?
So it wasn't fun in that way. It's just like, it's the removal of a negative. So it's almost like a negative reinforcement type of thing.
Yeah. That makes sense. But I'm curious, I guess, with this stuff we're talking about in sort of raising your own kids and me having no idea what I'm about to do with raising my own kid is like, how do we end up in a world where you work with children and adolescents and write a book called I Hate Myself? Like what produces that?
Let me answer that question, but let me ask you this. Do you have the book What to Expect When You're Expecting?
No, but I've definitely heard of it.
Do you know yeah, so that's, well, okay, so maybe in my generation, like everybody had that book, What to Expect. No one, not a single person has the book What to Expect the Day They Leave the Womb. You know, it's because all of a sudden, you know, yes, when this child is contained within the uterus and everything's very controlled, you know, you can sort of imagine like what do you expect that through those 9 months, and then they come out and like all sorts of hell breaks through, and it's sort of, that's why that book doesn't exist. So the second one, so what happened is I work specifically with highly suicidal young people to the point that many of the young people, we've had about 5,000 people come through my program, have either made suicide attempts or tragically, maybe somebody in their family has completed suicide. They just find life too painful to live on an everyday basis. And the, you know, if you think about, let's just take this out of the mental health realm for a second. If you imagine that your ability to, you know, do an ice cold plunge was critical for your survival and that you would die without it, you know, for some people it would be easy, for other people it would be hard, but everybody would have to do it, you know. And you would imagine that you'd work towards being able to do that. So if you think about when people have very strong and powerful and painful emotions to the point that death seems more palatable than living with those painful emotions, you'd think, well, why is it that some of us can have painful emotions and be okay, and others don't, others cannot be? And it's not because they choose that. It's because they don't have the skill set to be able to manage those painful emotions. And so what happens is, by teaching people life skills, you know, we automatically assume that people ought to be able to do something like walk or whatever it is. I mean, but you cannot do what you cannot do. You cannot speak Icelandic right now because you don't have the skill set to be able to do it. So what we did is we taught people life skills to manage strong and painful emotions. And that really reduced the suicidality in many of our patients. But there was this group, a smaller group, tragically, of this small group, a significant percentage took their life, that really hated themselves. It wasn't that they had painful emotions. It's that the way in which they saw themselves was that they were valueless, that they were worthless, they had nothing to contribute to society. And we would see a lot of people-pleasing behavior, a lot of perfectionism, in an attempt to get society's gratitude, society's appreciation. But nothing that they did overrode the self-hatred, because they believed it was a fundamental part of who they are. And this group was making more suicide attempts and really struggling with living. And so I thought, okay, well, let's just treat and target self-hatred. But I couldn't find any way to do it, because there's nothing in the literature that targets, no treatment that targets self-hatred. And there's very little research on self-hatred as it is. And so in a world and at a time when I'm seeing increasing amounts of self-hatred, we market to self-hatred, as I said earlier on. Kids don't have the confidence that they're able to do things and manage really difficult moments. They experience a lot of maltreatment. They internalize the idea that they're somehow irredeemably flawed. And those kids are at great risk of developing poor self-hatred and then, you know, thinking of suicide as the way out.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there. It reminds me of the quote that I've heard before, and maybe you can talk to how accurate you feel this might be, but the idea that when you criticize your children, they don't stop loving you, they stop loving themselves. So do you find these kids predominantly grow up in homes where parents are super critical, horrible addicts themselves? Mm-hmm. Like, is that the kind of picture that is the reality for these kids at home?
So that definitely is a part of it. But what ended up happening was that that's certainly something that I looked for, and certainly something I found. So there were people with their own mental health issues, addiction issues. Mm-hmm. They themselves were traumatized people themselves. They'd been abused themselves. But there was another larger group, and that is, so, you know, it was like parents who maybe they had other kids who were successful in the way that the parents determined was successful.
Yeah.
Sports, academics, and that sort of thing. And they praise these children for being so successful in their academics, in their sports endeavors, etc. And then comes another child who is extremely sensitive, isn't that academically talented, or isn't that, you know, sports-minded or physically minded. And it's not that the parents are putting those children down. It's just that they don't feel seen. They don't feel recognized by the parent. It's always like, wow, if you were more like Johnny, you know, you'd have all these people loving you and all of that sort of thing. The message is that you're not enough. So it doesn't necessarily have to be intentional, you know, maltreatment per se. Now, let's just say that there's a third kid and maybe the third kid is chubbier or something like that. Maybe they're not as talented in sports. And then they compare themselves a lot to their siblings. And then they go to school and they're told that they're fat and maybe stupid or something like that. What we know about strong emotions are like super glue to labels. So that if you're somebody who isn't that emotionally sensitive, you can just brush some insult off. But if you're emotionally very sensitive and you're repeatedly tormented with the messaging that you're not enough, you're going to believe that you're not enough. So yes, there was definitely that first group of people, but then there was also the group that were so sensitive that any sort of comparison made them feel, you know, terrible about themselves, and that they didn't have anyone to go and talk to. Because I certainly found a lot of people who had had those kinds of experiences, but who had loving parents and parents who were very attuned, who just loved the kid for who they were.
Yeah, that's so interesting. In some ways, you know, as you're discussing, you're sharing that, I'm thinking of my sister and I. Yeah. And my sister being that younger, overly sensitive, skills in different areas to me, and sort of grew up a little bit in my shadow, you know, and there's various, you know, familial consequences to that, which have in many ways been reconciled now, but it really takes me back to being a kid and that experience, what that might have been like for my sister.
Exactly. And it's such just to really underscore that point, for you to even think about that, just imagine like going back to her and say, you know, well, what was that like for you? You know, and also the expectation that she should live up to your standards when, you know, she was like ultra skilled in many other things that you probably weren't. Yeah. But because, you know, but the thing about it is that maybe in your family of origin, that those weren't valued as much. You know, maybe she, you know, she was a great piano player, but, you know, you like rugby, cricket, and ice diving, you know, so it's who knows what it was, or academics or psychology. And, you know, she wanted to arrange flowers or whatever it was. But then it was like, what are you going to do with that? You know, how are you ever going to make a living? And, you know, who are you dating? And all these sorts of things. Is that there, she's doing the best that she can with whatever her biology and her genetics and her capabilities have given her. And she may have just evaluated herself through your parents' lens, you know, vis-a-vis you, like in comparison.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, where the distinction or where the line is between, I guess, not feeling enough and then that becoming self-hatred, like that you're sort of, it's one thing to not feel enough. It's another thing to agree with the people that make you not feel enough. And at what point does that become depression? And is there a distinction between those two things?
Yeah. Well, you know, let's just, you know, I mean, you must have had some of your podcasts or interviews that haven't gone as well as you would have liked. And I mean, unless Maddie, you do them all 100% perfectly.
I wish.
But you know, they don't work out. And then maybe you're like kicking yourself. You sort of say, you know, that was, you know, why didn't I ask this question? Why didn't I go after this? Or, you know, there's some sort of dissatisfaction. But that's not because you are a fundamentally flawed human being. Is that in that moment, something external to you happened, caught off by something. Maybe you weren't feeling very well that day, but you realize like, okay, that's something that happened outside of me. Should that situation arise again, this is how I'm going to do it differently. You know, like, hey, I've had lots of podcasts with people don't have a microphone. If you don't have a microphone, we're not doing this. That's what you told me. So you corrected for that rather than have something, you know, this, we were, to your listeners, we were going to do this last week, but you said, no, this is not happening if you don't have a proper microphone. So you corrected for that. But it's not because you're a terrible podcast person. It's because, you know, you figured out something that didn't work. Now, imagine that if instead of that, you never wanted your guests to have a proper microphone, you never set that standard. And then every single time someone didn't bring a microphone, you said it's just because I'm this terrible human being, that it's because of you rather than it's because of your own nature, it's because of the manifestation of a flawed individual that you are. So the difference is this kind of an internal state of you-ness, like you know who Maddie is, that is, nobody else can be you. Mm-hmm. And your sister cannot, your parents cannot, they might understand you. So it's woven into the fabric of who you are rather than, you know, I really screwed this up. I can do this better at a different time. So that's an external, like, dissatisfaction with the self. You know, like, you could even, like, judge yourself, but you see it as something apart from you.
A bit of that in the beginning, in some context. And it looked like, you know, the situation where we get on the call, similar to the way that you and I did. And then mm-hmm. I'd be too nervous and I'd be like, mm-hmm. They've booked in time mm-hmm. in their schedule. Mm-hmm. And then I'd record the podcast. And the second we got mm-hmm. off, I'd be like, I should have said something that exactly. the audio quality was terrible. And then I would beat right. myself up for being weak, but not having the courage right. to say, we need to reschedule.
Exactly. And look, and you told me that last week. And what I did is I had to do something. I had to go speak to my the department in the hospital and saying, hey, I'm bringing in external hardware and this is something that's really important to me. And you know, here I am. And it, you know, no skin off your back. And I'm learning a new skill to record in this way. Even in that situation, you could course correct. But what would happen if even if I brought in all the external hardware, you still thought of yourself, you know, like no matter what you did, you just were dissatisfied. It's okay. I told my guest to get better equipment, better lighting. I told them what we were going to be talking about, et cetera, but I'm still this flawed human being, you know? So that all the corrections that you made would not be enough to override the sense that you're a flawed person.
Yeah. So that even if it went perfectly, I would still find a way to, it would be my fault. It's not perfect. It's not amazing. Right.
Exactly. And that's the other thing that I see a lot in perfectionists is that doesn't matter. And let's just say that by all accounts, every single person on the planet told you that it was perfect. You would then attribute that to luck rather than your own internal
or
skill.
Their delusion.
Exactly. Exactly.
I've done that in the past. Yeah,
right. Right. Yeah. You know, they have to say they love me because they're my parent. They have to, you know, they're delusional. If they really saw how flawed I am, they wouldn't be saying the same sort of thing or like they didn't understand that. And it's sort of like breaking yourself from that mindset, which is so difficult.
Does that mean at some point or even before it's fully formulated, the self-esteem has fractured in some way? Well, and maybe I actually don't know the answer to this at all. I've never asked the question like this, but are we born with a self of sense, like self-esteem? There is an innate self-esteem within us, or is that cultivated by the world in which we are born into? Or is it fragmented 100%. By those people?
No, I think that the child is born. Now, if you think about your child, I mean, you know, hopefully in the next couple of days for you, Maddie, I'm really excited for you. You know, your child is going to cry when it's hungry and it's not going to say, wow, Dad had a really long day and so did Mom. I'm going to wait until 6 o'clock in the morning to not wake them up because I want them to sleep. You know, the child behaves in a very biological way. You know, it cries when it's hungry. It poops when it needs to. It, you know, it learns to smile and all of that. And it begins to develop a sense of self as a consequence of the reflection of how the environment responds to its needs. So that if you tell the child, look, stop crying at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, you're really annoying and, you know, you're waking us up and we're cranky. And let's just say that you continue to do that, the child is going to begin to see itself in that way. If you can validate and recognize that, you know, that some days are harder than others, some experiences are more difficult than others, and that you can get through them, that's very validating. The other problem I see is telling everybody that things are going to be okay. We have absolutely no idea if things are going to be okay or not. If I say to you, hey, let's go hiking up Mount Kilimanjaro, and I say everything's going to be okay, I have no idea. It might or it might not be. If you've trained, you're much more likely to get to the top than if you haven't trained. So you can prepare a person for what to expect to the extent that you can, but still life circumstances, you know, might be overwhelming. I mean, I'm sure that people who got caught in that tsunami in Indonesia, many of them probably knew how to swim, but not under a tsunami condition, you know? So what are the conditions? So can you prepare somebody with the life skills to be able to make their own food, wash their own dishes, wash their own clothes, you know, tolerate frustration, have the skills to be able to do that, learn how to solve problems without solving it for them? Because that's what's going to give you your own sense of self-worth and your own belief in your capabilities rather than, you know, than the other way around. So I think that a child is just born. Now, for highly sensitive children, I mean, I'm a highly sensitive human being. I'm the eldest of eight, and three of my siblings are not sensitive at all. They're all engineering types, and they just like, no big deal, get on with it. I'm a highly sensitive person. And so, you know, like emotional things throw me, and I just have to like, you know, settle, regulate, and then get on with it. But that's internal to me. It's not because of what the world is doing. So a highly sensitive person, a highly sensitive baby is much more likely to have that sense of self-fracture, as you put it, much, much earlier on, and will be impacted by the ways in which the world treats it much more so than somebody who's not highly sensitive.
And with the, I guess, the people that you work with and the teenagers and kids with these suicidal ideations and thoughts, do they all fall into that empath kind of highly sensitive category, or can you also be, you know, a little bit more rigid in your or stable in your sense of self and still end up in that place?
So up until last week, I would have said I did not meet a single person who was not highly sensitive. And then I met a dad who was not necessarily a very, very sensitive person. I mean, a very loving dad, but, you know, I mean, things didn't seem to bother him emotionally that much. And he lost his son to suicide.
Oh, dreadful.
And he could not forgive himself. And he felt that he was to blame, and that had he had more of an emotional capacity, that he would have been able to save his son. And it was just tragic to hear the dad's story. The child had very severe mental illness and was really suffering. But that's the first time that I heard of an adult who had, you know, no mental health issues as a child, who was not necessarily very emotional or not emotional, just like average emotionality, who experienced a tremendous amount of self-recrimination and self-hatred because of this outcome. So whereas up until last week, I would have said, yeah, highly sensitive. And I think the predominance are highly sensitive people. Of course, it can happen that like a tragic event like that can happen, end up with a person feeling that way.
With the highly sensitive people, is the idea teaching people these life skills, are we trying to build resilience, or is there a way to sort of have a lever or a valve on the amount of sensitivity that we dial up or dial down? Because I feel like I would consider myself relatively sensitive. Emotional things throw me, you know, quite easily. And I'm in this world of mindset and psychology and personal development, which requires a lot of introspection and thought. I've, you know, been in therapy for 20 years because I find it fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it's not until sort of now-ish in my life that I can really compartmentalize or associate these are the people or the things I care about, and these are not. Those not things still affect me, but I'm getting better at less, that impact being less. But is there a way to, is the idea of focusing on physical tasks for the self, is that being able to dial in that sensitivity on the things that matter?
Yeah. So I think both are true. So, I mean, if you think about it, I was thinking about the dialing in. It's freezing here in Boston, as I told you earlier on. It's like minus 10 degrees Celsius. Now, I can program my thermostat so that when I get home, it'll be a nice and toasty, say 22. Mm-hmm. Or so that's something that I can change the environment that way and dial it up from very cold inside the house. but I can also put on a lot of warmer clothes, you know. So in other words, I can, there are things that I can do in my environment that I can say, look, if I stay up late at night, if I drink too much alcohol, if I, you know, party all night, I'm going to feel worse the next day. So those are things that I can change. Okay, I'm going to drink less. I'm going to party less. And, you know, maybe there's certain people that bring out the worst side of me, you know. So that's, those are factors that you can change because you're aware of their connection to your emotionality. But then there's situations. I mean, I was traveling back from LA and we had terrible weather and like the plane was like dropping 10 meters every, you know, couple of miles. And, you know, the lady next to me was just like really scared. And, you know, I, because I've practiced regulating my emotions through breath work and through meditation, I was able to stay settled. And she says, well, how are you doing that? I said, well, because I'm breathing, you know, like worrying isn't going to solve the problem of a bumpy air ride. Anxiety isn't going to solve the problem. So I have to, knowing I'm a sensitive person, knowing that it unsettles me, is I have to have the tools in the moment when those situations arise. So there's the two parts of it. It's having the skills and the awareness to be able to manage when those situations arise, mm-hmm. and practicing those skills when I don't need them so that when I need them, they're there. And also recognizing the vulnerability factors that are likely to set me off and then, you know, deciding like, you know, I don't need those things in my life.
I'm the guy on the plane that is like, whoa, here we go. We're alive. Like that stuff excites me. Like this is shaking me out of my bubble of like cushy cotton wool life. Exactly. And I'm like, here we go. This is being alive. Yeah. And the people around me are screaming and I'm like, woo. Right.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, and also like, think about that. The only difference is your attitudinal stance. Mm-hmm. It's, in other words, like there's an interesting thing that happens. Like, do you ever say like, oh, you know, I tend to, you know, have this tendency or I have a habit of, see, whenever you say that, it's no longer a tendency or a habit. It's a choice.
Yeah.
You know, if you say, I have this tendency to argue with people. Okay. If you know that's a tendency, it's not a tendency.
Yeah, you're displaying awareness.
You know that. Exactly. So it's not a tendency anymore. So just, you know, if it's not helpful, then don't do it.
Yeah. The funny thing is I'm going for my, after you and I finish, I'm going for my first ever flying lesson.
Cool. Yeah. Oh man, I wish I was there. Wait a second, the day before your baby's born?
Yeah, well, we're trying to squeeze it in because it was a gift for Christmas. And so we're trying to get things like that out of the way before they get totally forgotten about.
In a different direction.
So I guess, I know we don't have too much longer, but one thing that I was really curious to talk about in the context, particularly of kids that have access to social media and the way that the world is right now, is do you feel like in this personal development movement, that we encourage too much introspection and that people get lost within themselves or the exploration within themselves?
Yeah. Well, I actually, one thing that I thought that if ever I met God, I would say that God, you know, you had a design flaw in the human being. And God would say, well, what was that? And I said, you gave them the power to think. and it's because a lot of the people that I meet, the problem is in their thinking. And the problem is that when you start doing a lot of thinking, you start connecting things that have no connection to each other. And then you believe them to be true. So like, Maddie, the reason that you are like you are and your sister's like, she is because, you know, your parents gave you a rugby ball as a child and they gave her a rattle or something like that. And then you create these myths and then you believe them to be true. And then you spend a lot of time like thinking. Look, there's a benefit to thinking. Thinking is for planning. Thinking is not for worrying. You know, you're going to plan to go on your flight now and then be back in time because you're not going to do that when you have a kid. So that's what thinking is for. It's not for like whatever. And so I think that, you know, or you can use thinking for problem solving. Like, here's a puzzle. How are you going to solve this puzzle? But to sort of navel gaze, to sort of, you know, spend so many hours reflecting on the, I don't know, trauma of your life just keeps you stuck in a cycle of suffering. And you know, and I mean, listen, I do trauma work with people who've had bad sexual and physical abuse, but the goal is to not have them dwell on that because that's, you know, how to move from something hurtful that happened in the past to something in the present that isn't happening, and just accepting and seeing the magnificence of life in the present moment.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. I like that. And I think too, or maybe one way to think about it as a species that has been moving forward for however many centuries or millennia is that possibly we just haven't figured out that consciousness piece. And maybe the pursuit of being human is about every generation, you know, joining a few more dots and eventually we'll join it all together. And finally, we'll be like, oh, you know, the last 100,000 years of humans were kind of lost in their own mind, but we've finally found the piece that joins it all right. together, which brings up a whole conversation about what is consciousness.
Oh, I'd love to get into that topic one day, maybe after you've had a week of sleep deprivation. We can discuss this and then you'll say, screw consciousness, I just want to sleep.
Totally. This has been a great chat and I really love what you're all about. I love how you communicate and I honestly think we could sit here for 8 hours and just dissect and extrapolate and peel the onion. But for people that are listening and think you're amazing, which they should because you're awesome, where can they find you on the internet?
Thank you. Yeah, so my program at McLean Hospital at Harvard, McLean, famous for Girl Interrupted, is the number 3, the word east.org. That's my program, and it's McLean is Harvard's biggest psychiatric teaching hospital.
Yeah, fantastic. And where can they get your book?
Yeah, I think it's available in all major bookstores. I mean, certainly here in the United States, Amazon and all the other major bookstores, you know, order it online. And, you know, sadly, more and more like physical bookstores are closing down. But, I, if you still have them, support them. Pay the extra dollar or two to support, you know, very worthwhile service in the community.
Yeah, I agree. Keep small business alive in this economy.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And to wrap up, what is one piece of health information that you wish more people knew about?
Yeah, you know, anything that you do today in terms of your physical and emotional wellness is not for today. It is for 10 years' time. So that whatever you're doing, you know, people say, like, I'm too old to take care of myself, or I'm too frail, or whatever it is. The things that you do today, yeah, it'll benefit you a little bit today, but focus on the future. And the other thing is focus on what works. The older you get, the more weight-bearing exercises you have to do. So, you know, carry your groceries to your car rather than using the trolley. Cold is a beautiful healer. You and I both enjoy the cold, you know, that those cold plunges. And it doesn't have to be 3 minutes, 5 minutes. It can be 30 minutes in a colder shower. Get rid of any ingredients that you cannot pronounce on your packages. These chemicals, we weren't evolved to eat these chemicals. They cause tremendous inflammation in the body and make people, you know, ultra sick and cause a lot of aging. So I would just say, you know, you can manage your food through ingredients that you can pronounce. Carry more weight, and I'm not talking around your belly, I'm talking about your grocery bags, and then move it up from there, and let cold weather be your healer.
Fantastic. I'm an advocate and supporter of everything you just said, so it awesome. Sounds perfect. But thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your time and your energy, and hope to have you thank back you. In the future.
Oh, I would love that, and just like sending you just lots of love and to your listeners, and especially to your baby.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll catch you soon, Blaze.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.